I know people are still popping in. I know I sold this one hard. Yeah, you might have read of it. You know, Dave and I go way back. When I was kind of a nobody, we both hated The Secret. He didn't know who I was, and I basically got kind of double my list by writing a whole article about Power of Negative Thinking, taking it on, and then the right people came. And I saw Dave was doing similar things. He didn't know me. He had a fucking bitch of an admin because I could not get a meeting with him. Finally got in, and he answers, "Who the hell are you?" And I had like a second, and I was like, "I hate the fucking blah, blah, blah." And I Google this, and then he's like, "All right, let's talk." And it was like 4 hours later, and we agreed to take this down. And we didn't succeed, obviously, but we tried with Blair and built like this huge list that we never monetized. And Dave would get on there and teach how it was a cult because he was raised in a cult and he got out of a cult. And he actually like craziest background. I mean, as a DEA agent, infiltrated a satanic cult in Mexico, like understands this shit. And then was kind of the highest paid consultant for companies and people on persuasion. So he's been there and it's real. He would teach that. And this guy, Blair and Warren, is just a crazy, he makes persuasive videos and he would deconstruct it. And then I would just kind of sit there and listen and ask him questions. And so
Clinton's persuasion course is still probably the best persuasion course around.
By far.
Yeah.
So I just kind of got to ask a lot of questions as the interested observer and let them answer. And it's fucking powerful. Dave contacted me about the Out of the Shadows documentary and like, what the fuck? And it was so horrible, but persuasive. He was like, this would be a good opportunity for him to kind of do the same thing about that documentary, but also more. And he has a whole training in what they're doing. So we're going to discuss a little bit, and let Dave take over about the documentary, why it's working, which is going to be fun, but we're not going to get into politics here. This is more about the persuasiveness of it. And then he's going to teach some stuff and then we're going to see how you can apply it. And if we run out of time, we can do another step two on just application in another webinar. So Dave, take it away.
All right, man. I'm going to share my screen here real quick. So let me just see if I can make this thing big. Did that make this full screen on your screen or not? We'll just do it this way. That's fine. Okay. So this whole idea of this thing, just like Michael said, so when we did this thing about The Secret, he's kind of underplaying. I mean, we didn't take it down. We did sort of we pre-called what was going to happen with James, right? James Arthur Ray, though. Like we said, look, he's going to kill somebody. And sure enough, a couple of years later, he did kill three people. And, he went to prison and all these kinds of things. Like
I forgot the last part. Dave was on stage with all these people and I was there as an attendee and he's like, I'm just going to rail everybody. It's going to be bad. You better show up. And I was hungover, but I showed up to egg him on with questions and he basically just pissed off the whole room, just tore down a whole room of everybody else.
This is 200 of the biggest speakers in the world, Mark Victor Hansen, like guys like that, like they're all in they're all in this group. And yeah, I called them out, told them they're a bunch of assholes.
And they tried to shut him up, but I kept saying, no, let him answer. And and then we kind of got, it didn't go well for us after that.
I wasn't about to anyway, but it was, like Michael and I just like hammered him. It was, I had the stage and I spent 30 minutes just like tearing him apart because I've been watching all these guys take advantage of people and it was, I was sick of it. And so anyway, this movie Out of the Shadows has really done a lot of things right when it comes to creating a mass movement. And again, Michael said, no politics. It's inevitable that you have to talk about what the purpose of this thing is and who it's made by. And it's made by QAnon. And if you don't know who that is, you can Google it. And it is a very conservative right-wing view of the world. And so, but the interesting part about this movie and why it's important and why I pointed it out to Michael, number one is you look down here at the number of views that it's got, it's like 760,000.
Way more than that.
It's way more than that now. But the interesting thing about it is that it did an exceptional job of cutting across party lines and cutting across ways of thinking. So like it exposes things in a way that makes you, even if you don't believe these things, or even if you were a big fan of people, and it ties in enough imagery and ideas and reinforcement in the background that it cuts across those party lines and it makes people who are on the opposite side of their beliefs stop and think. And for those ones that are sort of on the edge or unconvinced, like it can pull them over very easily. So the reason I brought this up is several people who are in the group here called me directly and said, hey, what is going on with this thing? And so I was like, well, let me, and I watched it, but and I was like, this is such bullshit. And I didn't really, but I was amused by it because of how interesting it was and how good of a job they did. Mm-hmm. So hopefully people watch this ahead of time, because when I go through the hero's journey, I'm going to be talking about different sections, but I want to run through what the hero's journey is and what it looks like first. So the hero's journey in movies and books and things like that, all the best movies, all the best books that do really, really well follow this model almost to the T. And it's broken up into three acts, and it's got different elements. If you look at Joseph, it's based on Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey and the Monomyth. If you take a look at this whole thing and you say, you know, he has anywhere between 12 and 17 different pieces of the hero's journey, if you take a look at it. These 12 are the most widely accepted and the most usable for us as business people. So it's The Ordinary World, The Call to Adventure, The Refusal of the Call, The Meeting with a Mentor, Crossing the Threshold, Tests, Allies, and Enemies, Innermost Cave, Ordeal, Reward, Road Back, Resurrection, and The Return with the Elixir. So The Ordinary World is that uninitiated place. It's the place where we live every day. We're not thinking about it. We're just unaware. The Call to Adventure is where awareness is increased and you realize something's amiss. The Refusal of the Call is sort of that reluctance to change. I don't really want to change. And then A Meeting with the Mentor, which is overcoming that reluctance to change. And then Crossing the Threshold is committing to the change. Tests, Allies, and Enemies is experimenting with the change for the first time. Innermost Cave is the death and rebirth. And then The Ordeal is the tempt of the big change. This is that first, like, I'm going to give this a shot. The Reward is the consequence. It's sort of, it's called, pulling the sword from the stone. So it's the consequence of the attempt and the improvement and the rebirth and the setback. The setback always happens here. And then the road back, redoubles the effort to overcome. Finally, the resurrection is making the comeback and that first big effort that you win at. And finally, the return with the elixir is the final mastery, and you share the truth. So let's
I think a lot of us feel like they're on the road back right now, internally. I think a lot of us right now feel like they're on the road back right now. It's kind of
exactly. Well, you probably are if you watch this whole thing, right? Yeah, so you're thinking about it and wondering like, what is this? What does this thing really mean? So, so let's just sort of look at it through the. I'm going to talk about this as if you watch the movie because it's relevant to what we're going to talk about. So The Ordinary World. So he starts out in the beginning just as this stuntman, right? And he's just this uninterested guy who's like going through the world, being a stuntman, he's super cool. But I want you to look at the subtlety of what they're constantly doing around him, though. He's an action star. He's a badass. He's got swords behind him at different times. He's doing sword fighting and sword fighting kata, those kinds of things, right? So he's establishing himself as sort of this hard ass. And he's a stuntman. And let's just face it. I mean, you got to be kind of a badass to be a stuntman, right? So he's setting up this whole idea that, he was a regular guy, but kind of a tough guy. And, he was just living in this world doing this thing. Well, the call to adventure then happened. And the way he initiates it is he said, I never really had time for conspiracy theories or really to look into them, to know if they were true.
All right.
He doesn't say he didn't believe in them. He just said he never had time to look into them. But then he says things that most people don't believe is true. Flat Earth, Bigfoot, things like that, right? So he starts setting up this scenes of credibility around this idea that people don't understand. Then the refusal of the call is he just goes back to being a stuntman. He's just a stuntman. That's what he does. And, but he points out that he's the best stuntman in the world. And, he starts creating great authority by showing all of these movies. Doesn't say that he was actually the stuntman in these movies with the exception of Batman and a couple of others, but shows all these like intense action scenes and stuff like that. And, but then he gets injured and he shows this like crash and these kind of things. Again, doesn't demonstrate whether it's him or not, but this crash happens and he injures his low back. And this is important because this low back thing, while it seems subtle and innocuous, it's really not, because it leads to this very next thing of the meeting of the mentor, right? So he goes through physical therapy and all of these things, and he's just not quite getting better. And then he meets his mentor, who is a pelvic floor therapist, right? And at that time, one of the only ones in California, which is total bullshit, right? I mean, like this happened in the 90s or, maybe early 2000s. Nobody really knows what a pelvic floor therapist is, right? So either it's completely made up, which it's not. There actually are these people.
I got one.
Yeah, right. So they're not made up. And you know, and so he meets this person, this pelvic floor therapist. And so as he's going along, this pelvic floor therapist says, "You're just not getting better." He's like, "Yeah, I know. I'm doing all this work. I'm doing all these things, not getting better." And she says, "Well, I've noticed that there's dark spirits around you," right? So she has this unique ability to see that she can see these things around him. And she asks if she can pray for him. And he says, "Well, I wasn't a Christian. I'm not a Christian, you know, but I was like, whatever, I don't care. Go ahead and pray for me." And she does, and things start to change for him. And so as things start to change, he begins to notice that, you know, all these other things happening. And so during this time, he begins to really get better too, right? So he starts to heal. He starts to get better because of prayer, mm-hmm. apparently. So then the crossing of the threshold, he finds God. And he found during that time when he was discovering back here and meeting his mentor, he started discovering the occult and seeing the mm-hmm. truth of the occult. So he finds God. He has a complete rebirth. He's born again here, right? And so he also discovers simultaneously that the occult is real. And that is just more than he can bear. So he has to dig into this. He has to find out what the truth is. So he starts studying. And the important key here is he drops off the grid, like we all could if we wanted to, right? If you're a stuntman. And so he drops off the grid by just deleting his social media accounts, but recreating another anonymous social media account. Now, mm-hmm. it's important that you know that he says that it's anonymous, because who is anonymous?
Right. Right. I did not catch that. Got it.
Right. So it's who is anonymous. So anonymous is, you know, this group that goes and hacks people and does all of these things and, you know, all of that, but it's anonymous. And so he's anonymous, and he's going to go and watch and dig into all of these people, and he's going to figure it out. He's not saying he's anonymous, but that's the implication if you look at this really deeply. So he discovers all of these people. So the enemies that he discovers first are Sony and Disney and the CIA. Right? These big enemies. Like, these are people who are controlling the world. These people's messaging. And, you know, if you look at this, Disney owns it all. And, you know, they're doing all of these things. And they're, you know, he's implicating them in a lot of things during this. And he's showing you scene after scene after scene after scene fast, right? Faster than you can consciously take it in, right? And so, but you're taking it in for sure. Now, I want you to notice the interesting thing about this, because this is what's really, really fascinating about this whole thing that virtually nobody gets. And one of the things that really fascinated me about this, he's using virtually every technique that he accuses all of these people from, you know, the studios to the CIA and the MK Ultra project and all of these things that will come out later. He's using virtually every technique in this movie to make you become sucked into it and convert to his ideas, particularly if you're already aligned those ways. So I'm going to turn that off so I don't get any more noise. I apologize.
All right.
So when you look at this whole thing and you start thinking about it and you start looking at this, he also introduces at this point briefly some allies. So he introduces Brad, right? Mm-hmm. Brad, the other stuntman.
The other stuntman, yeah.
Who's a badass and also illuminated, right? And he's, you know, but he also quits. And this is important, especially when we talk a little bit later about Hoffer's true believer model. But he's mm-hmm. quit that all because he's found out the truth. And it's just, again, more than he can bear. He also introduces Ship, who is the CIA, he's a CIA whistleblower, right? Yep. So he introduces these people. But he also introduces the Illuminati too, right? All of these people who are controlling everything out of the background. And this also is important, the Illuminati particularly, because they show up over and over again in all mass movements in some way. And, you know, this Illuminati, as we, when we look at it in, you know, later on in Hoffer's mass movement models, it'll become really important. So then, you know, he introduces Ship, and you get your first view of this guy who, you know, left the CIA, and the CIA, you know, threatened him and all the things that, you know, that happens when you sue the CIA. So he introduces this whole idea. And so there's tests. The big test in this thing was that Sony got hacked. And, you know, he ends up having to get LifeLock, because Sony got hacked. Like, that was a big deal. Like, nobody doesn't have LifeLock now because somebody didn't get hacked, that you know. But Sony got hacked, and he worked in the movie industry, so he had to get LifeLock because it was so bad. And so he really builds up this whole idea that, you know, his he was compromised in this way, but he had to come back from it. Then the innermost cave, he discovers the depths of deception. He meets Brad, his new mentor, right? So Brad is his other stuntman buddy who is really, you know, building up this whole thing. And he's sharing information with him. Brad is just, you know, he's a loving guy who just wants the truth to be told, right? He wants the truth to come out. And that's it. So then it's the ordeal. And he exposes all of these things during his ordeal. It's just like mind-blowing, right? Like all the things that MK Ultra did, the way they just leveraged people by, you know, giving them LSD, and they didn't have their permission to do that. People didn't know what was going to happen, but it was to control their minds. And MK Ultra is a real thing, right? It's a documentable thing that were all kinds of a number of tests that happened during that time. And he introduces it and shows like all these different mind control manipulation things that they were studying in those moments, making no judgments about whether those things were good or bad, or we should or shouldn't do them. But it's a legitimate thing. Then he introduces Operation Mockingbird, which was a World War II, started around World War II, when they were recruiting all of the brain power, basically, of Nazi Germany. So the people who invented the VX rocket and all of these kinds of things, right? And they were bringing those people to the U.S., but they were talking about how Heinrich Himmler was the, you know, like he was the sort of the driving force behind all of these people. And, you know, they were all compromised in many ways. And some of them were very involved in compromise and mind control themselves. And Heinrich Himmler was a Satanist. And so he was the one who was, you know, committing a lot of these, you know, these real misdeeds. And he was sort of the real power behind everything mm-hmm. that happened during Nazis or for the Nazis during World War II. So he introduces that. And then he introduces Paperclip, which is another documentable CIA operation, right? So he's introducing all these things, and it's just like his whole thing, his whole worldview is completely blown now and completely transformed by this. And so he comes out on the other side, and he redoubles his search, right? So the result of this ordeal is he's got to know the truth, like the truth with a capital T. And so the reward that he gets for that effort and for really redoubling himself is a meeting with the smoking gun, who is Liz Crokin, this reporter who reveals all about Pizzagate. And what she reveals about Pizzagate is probably one of the most disturbing things any of us can think about as humans, particularly if you have children, which is pedophilia, right? So, you know, if you're a parent, even if you're not a parent, really, I mean, if you're a human being, the thought of somebody being a pedophile and, you know, sexually abusing children is, it's probably one of the most morally devastating, psychologically impactful things that could be revealed about a person or that you could reveal about a group of people. And so, like, you could say somebody's a Satanist and people are like, yeah, well, I might not like that person. You say they're, you know, a pedophile and you kind of want to kill them, right? So it's like, it has that much emotion around it. So Liz Crokin reveals this smoking gun, right? And she reveals Pizzagate, and she starts talking about all of this evidence she has and all of the things that she tried to expose and all of the ways that she tried to expose them. And it all comes back to pedophilia and, you know, sexual deviantism and Satanism. And so it's all of these things that are so counter-Christian. Right, they're anti-Christian in every possible way. You could have taken out pedophilia and just left deviant sex in there, right? Mm-hmm. And that would have been enough. But you take it one other level, and now you've created such, because there always has to be us versus them, good versus evil, light versus dark, right? And so now they've really, really established this. There's this group of people, the Illuminati, Disney, the entertainment industry, liberals, if you will, you know, who are in charge of all of these things. And, you know, the fact that it's proven is because the CIA is really the one in charge, because they have a liaison office, which he establishes earlier in Hollywood. So we get to Liz Crokin, and they give her a tremendous amount of time to, like, lay out all of this stuff that happened during Pizzagate and why it's true. And so on the road back, they start to really take a look at a number of different things that are really critical. So SHIP starts really digging into the, you know, again, MK Ultra and Operation Mockingbird, and it launches his discovery of more, right? So he's just like, now he's just like, oh my God, my mind's blown. I see it everywhere. Everywhere I look, I can see all of these things happening. It's like Neo in the Matrix, when he finally sees the Matrix and he can see everything that's happening all around him. He's taking it all in and he realizes like everything is the Matrix. Well, he realizes everything is this massive control effort of mind control and propaganda and all of these things. But he introduces you to the idea, the you know, the resolve and the salve that will help you if you just use it. And it's a simple thing that virtually everybody has, right? Or at least believes they have, because most people actually don't, but they believe they have it. And it's critical thinking. And a lot of people imagine, most people imagine they're good critical thinkers. What they're really good at, though, instead, which is a whole other talk, is bias, right? They're good at confirmation bias, especially. And so he introduces the idea that I had to start critically thinking because this stuff was around me so much, I had to detach myself, like Brad, who detached himself from all media. But he had to detach himself so he could see this stuff and start using critical thinking to know what the truth was and what wasn't the truth, right? And so if he used critical thinking, then he could do that and he would be able to, and so would you. Then in his resurrection, he exposes Podesta, right? So Podesta is sort of like, he's the evil mastermind behind all of this thing, right? And, you know, they show him when he's young, they show him when he's in the army, they show him all of these different times, they show him in his, you know, and he's also the head of the Temple of Set, and they show him in all of these different satanic places, and they show him talking about, you know, having gone to Heinrich Himmler's retreat in Germany and doing a black magic ritual in the same place Heinrich Himmler did, and he's got a knife, a dagger that came from Heinrich Himmler, and he exposes everybody then. He exposes Podesta, he exposes Epstein, he exposes the Clintons, and on and on and on and on. But
even
he doesn't.
Even Lady Gaga.
Even Lady Gaga, right. Wow. Yeah, yeah, and Kelly Clarkson, right? So yeah. It's all of these people. And Kelly Clarkson, again, he uses because she is the, you know, she has got a very clear path between good and evil, right? Light and dark. She started out as a gospel singer. Now, if you look at her videos, they have all these highly sexualized, satanic, ritualistic kinds of imagery in them, right? And so that causes people to look at it and say, oh my God, this is amazing. This is crazy. Like that really happened right in front of us. I saw that whole thing unfold because she's fairly new. Lady Gaga, again, because she's so popular. But they start then reinforcing this whole idea, like, look who shows up at these things like spirit dinners where people do all of these things. And they keep shooting back to this, you know, this menu on the wall of, you know, like chilled breast milk and sperm and all of this stuff that goes into this thing, right? Which is, you know, for most people, they would find that vile and off-putting. And so they keep reinforcing this thing. And whether you're actually paying attention to it or not, you're picking it up though. There's so much subliminal imagery that's delivered at high speed, out of slight focus, out, you know, those kinds of things that people take in, and they don't understand why they're so impacted and moved by this thing. But your mind can take in more than your eyes. And so that's the result of what's happening here. And then this sudden shocking imagery that, you know, people are stunned by when he reveals, like, people are eating, you know, cakes made to look like bodies and, you know, brains and all this kind of thing. And, you know, then, you know, they're showing this initiation of, you know, a naked woman walking through a field, you know, trusting her guide, which is what Satanists do, as if, you know, they have a universal set of rules that say this is a thing that you do and part of your advancement. And then finally, they start talking about the symbols. And, you know, they have Jim Carrey showing like, oh, you don't know what this symbol means. You don't know that, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, and he's like calling these people out. And then Ricky Gervais is calling everybody out. Like, you know, like, I know you guys are all friends of Epstein and you all like him and all this kind of stuff, right? So they're leveraging all this social proof, all of these big ideas. And during this resurrection, like, look, it's everywhere. You'll see it if you just look around. People's minds are blown now. And they're like, oh my God, that's actually true. Like, I've seen these symbols. I've seen these things, right? I've seen all this stuff when I look around. I didn't know that it meant all those other things that have gotten here to this point, right? So that is this resurrection. So everybody has followed this process and they're going through this process with them. And the people who are not, you know, most of the people on this, you know, on this webinar, and Michael and I, and probably Natalie too, at this point, like, I don't think, Michael, I bet you didn't get this far in the movie, right? You're probably like, fuck this, I can't watch it.
Not until you maybe watch the rest of it, no.
Right. So then you finally watch it and you realize in this moment, like, this is the whole thing. Like, people who get this far, if they've been on the edge, or if they feel disenfranchised, or if they feel a number of different sorts of internal emotions around not being, you know, like the man's trying to keep them down, and especially during a time like this where people are being laid off, where bad things are happening, all this stuff is going on, and like people are like, you know, like behind the scenes, they're saying somebody's controlling all this, and they start looking for the big game. Then they start watching, you know, and they're like, I see it everywhere I look. I see it everywhere I look. I see it everywhere I look. Boom. They have their own resurrection, right? And they're like, this is it.
It's just like, I mean, it's just like keto, right? Whether keto is true or not, everybody who gets on keto or starts to get the resurrection phase, all they see is sugar everywhere. And sugar, yeah. And oh my God, and the dietitians, they're the sugar conspiracy, right? So once they see the conspiracy, because that's the way keto is marketed as a sugar conspiracy, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and then people, we just make patterns. That's what humans do. We make patterns. So if you show a pattern, people will see it.
Yes, and they'll see it over and over and over again.
Right? I was looking at this is the whole keto movement. Not that keto is bad, but this is exactly what keto is. And now I did it, and all of a sudden I'm like, sugar, the enemy, and then you're a fucking sugar fucking whore. You know, like, right. I don't trust you now.
Right.
I went through that.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you look at this, all this is all psychological priming leading up mm-hmm. to this, right? It's priming, 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 then the reveal. And that's when the priming takes effect, because you're like, oh my God, in this highly emotional state, you know, I see it now. Because they've given you so much additional imagery in the background, like your mind kind of is blown a little bit at this point, right? Where you're just like, holy shit, this, like, there's a moment when you sort of have to think about it. Like, you literally do have to step back and do what he says and critically think. Mm-hmm. You just can't critically think through a lens of like complete bias, right? Because anybody who watches this, who already believes this kind of thing, this is complete confirmation bias. Anybody who isn't sure, but they've heard about it and they've thought about it, this is so overwhelming that it's highly likely to push you to the other side. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the return with the elixir. It's, you know, it's the big truth, right? And it's really understanding this whole idea that, you know, tell the truth to the world. That's what he's doing. That's all he's doing, is he's telling the truth to the world, right? And it's, you know, he's giving up himself, right? He's sacrificing himself. And Brad's already done it, you know, so it's too late for Brad. Brad's totally screwed. But what he's really doing, though, is he's telling people to watch for symbols in the resurrection part, right? This symbol thing is important, because QAnon and organizations like that have symbols of their own, right? They have ways of knowing each other in the dark. And this is really important later on when we talk about, you know, messaging for yourself. You want to have this information, and you want to have a language of your own that people can communicate with, just like keto. Like, there's lots of ways, like fat bombs, right? Like, that's a big, big word in keto, right? Everybody knows what it means, and we all like come around it, and we're like, yeah, fat bombs. I got to have a fat bomb.
The ritual of taking the bun off of your hamburger.
Right. Ritual. Right.
You're with me now.
Yeah. You're with me now. Yeah. We're together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So then he comes back, the return of the elixirs. He has to expose this truth to the world. He's sacrificing himself to do it. But all he wants out of this is not, he doesn't want everybody to like hate these guys or reject them in any way. He's not, because he tells you, like, not all movies are bad. Not all, you know, not everybody in the entertainment industry is bad. And what I really want out of this is forgiveness and compassion and inspiration and love. It's all about the love, baby. That's all we want, is a little bit of love. And if we get that, then it's all good. Everything is okay. And the very last scene of the movie is this, which I think is very interesting. And it says, the truth is learned, never told. Now, this is a fascinating sentence, probably the most fascinating sentence in the whole movie to me. The truth is learned, never told. All he's done the whole movie is tell you the truth. But he's presented it in a way that is so, so well done, that you feel like you learned the truth. He didn't tell you the truth. And so he's able to explore and expose this whole thing. And he's also explored the idea of critical thinking, right? And so, you know, it's learned. And if you're a critical thinker like me, you'll discover the truth because I didn't tell you what the truth was. I even told you these people, not all bad, right? Some of them are bad. I mean, I told you about that, but not all of them, just some of them. And so the truth is learned, never told. And as you look around and follow your eyes, right, and you listen to what you can hear around you, as you look at these, you know, movies from Disney and notice that they're sexually exploiting children and that they're, you know, always killing a significant family member early on, you'll discover the truth of all of this and you'll see how big a web it is. And when you pull on one string, you'll be able to find where it leads. Not because I told you, but because you discovered it on your own. This is also really important for Hoffer's model as well.
Yep.
So this is the true believer model. And the true believer model has, so Michael, let's just have a quick discussion about the true believer too, because I think this is important. If you haven't read the book, The True Believer, by Hoffer, you need to read that book. Like, this is a book virtually every marketer, every business owner, every human being should read before you really embark in anything, because it's such a basis for how movements form. It probably does the best job of any book I've ever seen of really breaking down how movements, you know, how they form and how they grow. The interesting thing about Hoffer is he wasn't a psychologist or anything. He was actually a dock worker who just deeply studied this stuff and really, you know, really observed at a very, very deep level what was going on. And he wrote this book, and he wrote some about politics and different things as well. Yeah. But Michael,
he was discovered late too, because nobody read him. Right. And then his true believers before World War II, before Germany, and then people reread it, go, oh my God, this is what fucking happened. Yeah. And he's just a weird insight on human psychology. Like, Impassionate State of Mind is a book of aphorisms. Like, that's on my nightstand. Like, that's probably the most insightful thing I've ever read about humans. Because he's like, passion's bad. Everybody's like, get passion. It's like, no, passion's where evil starts. Anyway, you go days on Hopper, just as a human, let alone a persuasion guy.
Right, right. So what, you know, so when you read The True Believer, what was your experience? Like, how did you think about it in terms of how it would impact business?
I didn't. I mean, I read it as a, you know, being raised a Jew and Germany's bad and all that. So I could really never get away from like all the horror stories I heard from all my relatives. So reading Hopper to me, The True Believer, I wasn't thinking about marketing. It's more like, oh fuck, that's how it all happened. Cause I'm so imprinted with the whole, that narrative is so deep in me from like my relatives, you know, beating that into me. It was like, wow, that's what fucking happened. And they weren't bad people. So it gave me sympathy actually.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes complete sense, right? Because once you understand, it does give you compassion for other people who get pulled into these things. Because but it also, and I'm not making fun of you when I say this, but it's, you know, it also sort of belies a set of bias as well. Like, right, if you can feel compassion for those people, it's because they're not as enlightened as you.
Right.
Right. And so it sets up this other thing. That, you know, and I feel the same way, by the way. Like, when I see people getting sucked into cults and all those kind of things, like, I feel great compassion for them. And inside of that is my own bias and my own belief that I'm superior somehow, right?
Always.
So I don't want to ever have anybody think like I'm superior to any of these people, because I fall prey to my own biases every day.
All the time.
It's important to really understand this book and this model, because this is how you create raving fans. This is how you create, you know, cult brands. This is where all of this stuff happens in this hero's journey and this true believer model. So the first step of the true believer model is a desire for change, right? You're not trying to recruit everybody in the universe at one time. You're trying to create people inside of your universe who have a desire for change, right? So in the diet universe, which is a great one to think about, or in the alternative complementary health, whatever universe, right? There's always a group of people who, you know, who've been to doctors and they've never been able to get well, right? They have a desire to get well. They have a desire for change, but nobody's ever been able to do it. Or you've wanted to lose weight, but you've never been successful. There's a desire for change there. So they're discontented people who place control outside of themselves, right? It's not, you know, they can't control their body. That's why they need keto or, you know, low carb or low calorie or whatever it is that they choose, right? Paleo, name your diet. they need something else because it's not them controlling themselves and their impulse control and all, you know, using good mm-hmm. sense. It's that their locus of control is someplace else. And if I just know this other thing, then I'll be able to, you know, be successful. And there's no hope for change as an individual, right? Ideal candidates for a movement seek self-renunciation, right? So as an individual, you can't do it by yourself, right? There's no, like, there was no single first keto guy, right? There was a movement, right? There was no a keto person. There was all of a sudden a bunch of keto experts, people who had done it, but bam, bam. As soon as that came up, hey, me too, right? And then like start talking to you about it, which is really important because that's where leadership and all of those things roll up.
This is the whole psychedelic movement and the Burning totally. Man, and this is all based on the desire for change and discontent.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is.
And the psychedelic movement is based on this.
So when you're thinking about marketing, this is really important. Like a lot of times we think, oh, if people just discover this, right, once they hear about it, then they'll, you know, like if you build it, they will come. Right. That's the whole sort of premise. Like this, I built a better widget. Well, there's usually very few better widgets. There's better marketed widgets. Right. And so this whole thing is when you start thinking about your marketing and you start thinking about audiences and you start thinking about who you want to sell to specifically, you've got to start locating these people who have a real desire for change. Right. You've got to think about that in a meaningful way and say who inside this group is, you know, not individualized. I mean, so Michael is the ultimate individual, right? Like if you told Michael he was part of a cult and he was part of a group and he was part of something else, he'd say, fuck off. No, I'm not. You know what? I'm smarter than that. And I know what I'm doing. And he would make 1,000 excuses for, even if he got sucked into it, about why he is still an individual. Right. Oh, but wow. People who are, yeah. But and again, this is not criticism of you. This is just how you are. It's how I am. Yep. Right. And so, But the reality of it is, though, is that he did do keto, right? So he did have desire for change along certain lines. And I'll bet whoever got him into keto was a lot like him. They had similar kinds of other world views. And he was willing to give up his individualism of eating whatever the hell he wanted, whenever he wanted, in order to be more like this other thing that he envisioned in his head was possible. And somebody else demonstrated externally to him. He was willing to give up his locus of control to someone else or another thing, keto, in order to get a result that he wanted. So this is really, really important that you start thinking about what is the desire for change? People inside this target market, what do they have? Because if you can identify that desire for change and those people who are willing to do it, and you can be the example or you can create an example. This is why influencers work so well and all kinds of other things. You can show that example of why people want to be that way. This is the biggest and the most important hurdle that you get to, because it's all a very slippery slope from here.
Right. But you're seducing them to a movement, not a product.
Correct.
Because until the frame of the Correct. Movement is set, the product doesn't matter.
That's right. No, the product is irrelevant at that point. You're just, and you're identifying their worldview. Like you're making them feel like, yeah, I felt like this my whole life, you yep. know? Then you label the converts, right? The new poor. So Hoffer calls them the new poor. And it's because they've lost something valuable and significant, right? It could be literal wealth, but it could also be their loss of their vision or version of identity that they had. So, you know, you get fat, but you still remember who you were when you weren't, right? So you've got this idealized vision of yourself. And so the new poor is, you know, that person who has lost something, that vision of themselves. They've lost their identity. Or they've literally lost wealth. In the case of, you know, in the case of the movie, this guy had to quit being a stuntman. He had to give up his career, you know, in order to be able to do this and have a sense of what's right in the world. Like you can't hold both ideals, right? Things were better once is another big belief too. Like there was always a time when it was better. You know, back in my day, you know, we were able to ride our bikes without helmets and fall on concrete without, you know, concussions and all of these kinds of things, right? There was always this idealized better time, right? Paleo is a perfect example of that.
God.
The idealized better time, right? It's, you know, cavemen. I'm pretty fucking sure cavemen did not have the answers, right? They got awfully lucky in the evolutionary process, but I'm confident that they didn't have all the answers. And they also didn't have all of the constraints or the inputs that we have today. So in an idealized time, they probably ate as well as they possibly could with the constraints that they had. And as a result, they evolved until they stopped and then another evolution happened. But that's not what we think about. We go back and look, when was the biggest evolution of our time? Mm-hmm. Well, the Paleo times, right? So that's obviously the right way to eat.
They lived to at least 40.
At least, you know, like the really old ones. Yeah. And so that was, you know, so there's that whole idea. And again, I'm not knocking Paleo.
Yeah. Sorry, Dave.
It's just an example, right? But here's the whole idea. By giving a label to people, you give them a way of identifying themselves and identifying other people like them. And you give the movement a name. You give the movement, it's a thing, QAnon, right? We're anonymous, but we're Q. And he ties that all the way back to Ian Fleming and how the CIA hired Ian Fleming, you know, to help them begin recruiting people for the CIA through Hollywood and by giving them inside information about how they train and what they do and having advisors, all these things. So people would be, you know, really want to come to work for the CIA. That's probably actually true, you know, and it's genius if you can get it done, right? If you want to hire the brightest, smartest people in the world, you start making it super cool to be a spy. So that's, you know, but you give them a label. And so think about Q. Who is Q in the James Bond movies? Well, Q is the super cool gadget person, right? You know, like they know everything. They're able to do it. So you give them these labels and they're able to hang on to the label and do even more. And then finally, there's unlimited action or united action, I'm sorry, and self-sacrifice, right? So the united action is everybody starts moving together. Self-sacrifice is, sorry guys, I can't spell apparently. There we go. So the self-sacrifice is that it doesn't matter what happens to me as long as the movement carries on. So, you know, for people who don't know, quick backstory to me. So I grew up in a cult from the time I was 6 until I was 16. I grew up in a religious cult. The cult that I grew up in believed in no education past 6th or 7th grade. They believed in an end time prophet named William Branham. They believed he was a literal resurrection of Elijah from the Bible. They believed that women needed to be subservient to men, and if they weren't, corporal punishment was allowed. No cutting your hair if you were a woman, no wearing a garment that pertained to a man. Men had to keep short hair. I've still managed that. And then they couldn't have beards, you know, on and on and on with all these rules, right? Very restrictive, very, very much us versus them. There was the world and there was us, and the people who followed the prophet were going to go to heaven, everybody else going to hell. There was going to be a literal resurrection. You know, the dead would come alive again, all those kinds of things. But the ultimate self-sacrifice for us was being able to go out and, you know, not be in the world, not engage in these things, and to do whatever it took, take whatever blows, slings and arrows that came to you for being this way. Same thing in this movie. Like, look, I don't know what's going to happen to me. The implication for him all the time is like, look, these guys could kill me anytime, right? The only thing he didn't do, which I found very interesting in this movie, Michael, was that he didn't bring up like all the people that got killed. Right, he mentions it like very, very briefly. Mm-hmm. Somebody died, but he just sort of looks, you know, he goes across that. But anyway, this whole idea of united action and self-sacrifice is that the individual goals and the opinions are unimportant. The important aspects of life come from the group, right? So the group is driving back what you believe, right? It doesn't matter what you think, you need to stay in line. And this is why these groups grow, right? So people will shed from the groups all the time. Like people get in and be like, this is bullshit, I'm gone. But a lot of people start looking at it and say, what should I think? This is where groupthink comes from, right? So what should I think? What should I say? What should I do? And this is where they really heavily use persuasion, manipulation, and proselytization to move the masses, right? So they're constantly using psychological persuasion techniques. They're using all the techniques we use in marketing and PR and in mass media, right, to move these masses. And they also use manipulation, right? So they will coerce, they'll manipulate, they'll do anything they can to get these people to do it, and they'll prophesize. And if you know what that means, that's just like going around and sharing this message however you can. It's all the QAnon people that show up at Trump rallies and they're forced to cover up their Qs, right? And that hits the media and that spreads, and then that activates a bunch more of them. And then there always has to be a devil, but there doesn't have to be a God. And that's the important thing. You don't have to believe in a higher power, right? Because that would be kind of questionable if you're not careful, because that could be like the Illuminati too, right? They could be the higher power. But the important thing is there has to be a devil. There always has to be something that the group is against, that they're riling against, and that they're going against as hard as they can all the time. If that devil doesn't exist, the group falls apart. In my case, it was a literal devil in hell, right? When I was growing up. And so The fanatic is perpetually incomplete and insecure, is what Hoffer says. And that's an important thing to think about from a marketing perspective, because you're really looking, like, you know, when you talk about 1,000 true fans and all of those kinds of things, 1,000 true fans is the fanatic, right? It's the person who's perpetually incomplete and insecure. Like, they'll never be able to have all the records. They'll never be able to have that one, you know, cut that was made in a basement that seven guys have on a tape that, you know, they desperately want. They're insecure, right? And when you're thinking about this from a marketing term, you need to always know who the devil is. And you always need to know what would make people feel incomplete and insecure. Because whatever you can do to make them feel incomplete and insecure is what's going to allow you to have brand extension, product line extension, all of those kinds of things, right? And this is not manipulative. It's not, you know, we're not saying just figure this out and constantly, unless you do that, right? Unless you make it manipulative and you just fuck with people because you can, right? It's really just understanding that a lot of people, when they're in a movement, when they're a cult of customers, they're going to feel incomplete and insecure, and that's why they're doing it. And so you just have to make sure that you constantly reinforce that and feed them and show them more. And you also want to feed that insecurity and assuage it at times too, by giving them like, oh, look, I found 10 of these books, right? Or I found 20 of these things. And you know, if you get them, you can get them. And that makes them feel like, ah, I won, you know? So that's a big win for them. Then there's a beginning and an end. And there's three people inside this beginning and end phase of this movement. And beginning and end could also be called rise and normalcy, right? Because it's a rise of this whole thing, and it takes a certain set of people for that. And then normalizing it and making it accepted, it takes a third person. So the beginning are the men of words. They discredit current belief and they create a hunger for faith, right? So, and this is what this person sort of is, right? He's the man of words that made this movie. He's the person who is discrediting all the current beliefs and creating a hunger for faith, something to believe in, a better time, that there is another way, right? So he's creating this angst in the midst of a lot of angst that we're all feeling right now from being locked down, from the coronavirus, COVID-19. Like, everybody's feeling a lot of angst right now, and they're hungry for something to believe in. They want to understand, like, what caused this? How did we miss this, right? So the timing of the release of this is impeccable, really, in terms of like being able to catch people's attention. Then there's the fanatics. They're vicious and destructive. They're fulfilled by ongoing struggle for power and change. Now, I'm going to say something that will sound political here, but it's not. It's an observation. There's a very strong argument in this whole movement, right, that Trump is the fanatic.
I was about to say that. He's not the man of word. He's the fanatic and not the man of action.
No, he's not a fanatic. He's definitely not a man of action, right? Mm-hmm. So he is the fanatic, right? So he's willing to destroy. And he's fulfilled by that ongoing struggle for power and change, right? That's what fulfills him. And if you look around, you need to think about who are those people. And these typically, when you're marketing, these fanatics are people who are highly vocal. They're the people who come and defend you when somebody says something really negative to you, you know? And so, you know, it's very interesting. So I got caught in a thing that was unintentional at all, but there was this, you know, there was a cult group that kept track of all these cults and all these things that was online. And it was purchased by Scientologists at some point. And I missed the memo that, you know, Scientology, but they didn't change it. So when you went back and looked, it wasn't like, oh, suddenly this looks like Scientology. So I quoted something out of that. And there's this counter.
You did that on my podcast, and that's when you got in trouble because you messed up once, and they would never forgive you. It was crazy.
Oh no! They crucified me,
yeah,
right?
They did.
You know, yeah, and so it was fine. But you know, at first, I started fighting back with them. I was like, guys, look, I was trying to be reasonable, right? And I was trying to say, like, look, you know, it was an honest mistake, right? I didn't know. Thanks for, you know, I even said thanks for letting me know, you know, and I'll make sure that I let everybody else know too. No, that wasn't good enough, because these fanatics, once they get a hold of you, they have to tear you apart.
Yep.
So I had to do the only other possible thing I could do, which was stop responding altogether, but I had to activate my fanatics. And then I had to get them to come into that group and destroy these people. They were willing to have this ongoing raging battle with them, right? You know, so all of my persuasion people and all of my people who were, you know, anti-cult, get them to come in and just fight this fight for me. And I had to back completely.
I remember that, because I had you on about how to stay away from fucking evil cults, and you were helping them, and you made one little error and they wouldn't.
Yep.
It's crazy town. And you were on their side. We even recommended their group.
I did totally recommend. Yeah. It didn't matter. Like, none of that mattered. I made a mistake, right? I made one mistake, and the fanatics will kill you. They'll burn you at the stake for that. And so, but my fanatics were ultimately stronger. Now it's, you can't even really find it anymore. And so that was fine, but it was, but that's the power of fanatics. And so you need those people and those fanatics. So you'll notice them in your marketing because they're the people that will defend you at any cost. They're the people who will destroy anybody who dares say anything about you. And, you know, it's the person who's going to call Michael and I afterwards and tell us how fucked up we are because we said something bad about paleo, right? It's those people, and that's okay. You know, you need those people in these movements. And finally, it's men of action. The men of action take over from the fanatics because the fanatics, left to their own devices, will just destroy everything. They'll just break everything because that's where their fulfillment comes from. But the men of action are the people who take over from the fanatic, and they move the groups away from self-destructiveness, and they move the movement towards a social institution, right? They start to make it normalized. They start to make it a group that makes sense. They soften the attacks. They create more critical thinking, right? They demonstrate to people through all of the methods that this person used in the video why they're probably right. They use ideology to reinforce doctrine. So they don't tell you what to think anymore, right? Remember when he said you can't, you know, you can't, the truth has to be learned, never told, right? So when you go back to that and you're looking at this, they can't give you doctrine anymore. They can't tell you, here's our list of doctrine. You have to do these things. They have to give you ideologies that fit the doctrine so that you can follow it. And then they have to connect you back to any source that holds your attention or trust as a true believer. Right? So it doesn't matter what, they're always going to connect these dots. And the perfect example of connecting these dots in the movie is when they identify or when they introduce Liz Crokin. Mm-hmm. She's a journalist. She's got credibility. She's done all these things. They just constantly go over and over and over her credentials, and they connect to any ideology, and they do it over and over and over again. Right. And so back and forth to the CIA, to the NSA, to everybody, right. They go back and forth. So
we have a question. Who are the men of words? Somebody's asking a question, like, are they the influencers? Like, who are the men of words?
The men of words are the people who mainstream. So like the people who, like, a lot of the men of words are the people who have left the Trump organization, for example, and they've started writing, like John Bolton is a man of action, right? He's a person who was one of Trump's closest advisors, but now he's coming out and saying, look, we've got to all use some reason.
See, but who's a man of words, not of action?
Oh, I'm sorry, man of words. So, like, men of words right now are these people like QAnon, right? QAnon are men of words, but out of QAnon come the fanatics, right? And so it's you know, the people who are also men of words are like, you know, I'm a huge Second Amendment fan. Like, I'm not suggesting that there's anything wrong with that, but, like, that come out of that Second Amendment movement. It's the people who are, like, the really... In this case, for this movie, the really right-wing pundits who are writing all the time. Those are the men of words. But they inspire the fanatics, right? And the fanatics are the ones who are just going to go out and break everything. They're the ones who go out and, like, literally blow things up, kill people, punch people in the face.
Or like in health, like for biohacking, like a man of words might be Asprey, and then he has the Bulletproof Army, which are the fanatics. Right?
They're the
and
fanatics, then, right. Or, you know, I mean, I would also argue that there was a time when Tim Ferriss was a fanatic, like, when he's going to Africa to have, you know, like, bone marrow drawn and stuff like that. Like, he was a fanatic at that point, right? He's willing to break this whole system to write this book and do everything that he did. Mm-hmm. And then the men of action along the biohacking community are people like Ben Greenfield, right? So he's not a fanatic, but he is definitely somebody who's mainstreaming it, right? Asprey is still up here, though. You're right. He's a man of words, right? He's still kind of pushing the edge. He's like, you know, he's creating the doctrine and that kind of thing. So then you look at Ben Greenfield. He's just saying, look, I'm reviewing the science. You know, people like, there's on and on, and a good number of people, a bunch of people in Baby Bathwater who are men of action along the biohacking line, right? Or Ben and Baby Bathwater. So there are a lot of people that follow that. They're trying to convert this group of people, and they're not doing it in a malicious way, right? Like Ben Greenfield, I don't think is malicious. I don't think he's, you know, trying to do anything negative. He's just trying to expose this and grow it. So as a marketer, you know, if you think about who are, you know, who are men of words, right? I'm gonna use Baby Bathwater as the example here, and I could be totally wrong about this, right? But I'm gonna say that men of words in Baby Bathwater, that, you know, that the men of words are the people who go out and spread this message pretty aggressively, right? Like, you know, hey, I got to tell you about baby bathwater. You know, they're, you know, all these other bullshit organizations you belong to and masterminds and that kind of thing. Like that's, those are the people, those are kind of the men of words. Fanatics though are Michael. Like Michael is the fanatic in the group and he's willing to be vicious and destructive and he's fulfilled by ongoing struggle around this, like discrediting bullshit and all of those people. Like he won't hesitate. And that, I think that's the truth of you. And if you're, if I'm wrong, you can of course say, fuck you, Dave, you're wrong.
I play all roles in different contexts.
Huh?
Like we all do. Yeah, I think we all play these. We all play all three of these in different contexts.
In different contexts.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think Hollis is more the man of action, right? He's sort of the peacekeeper. Hollis is kind of the guy who's out there saying, hey, look, you know, like here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make this all peace and love. He even looks like a hippie, right? So it's like, you know, I'm not saying anything bad about hippies either. But you like, I mean, like if you look at Hollis and you look at Michael, like Michael, I mean, I think if you want somebody to punch you in the face, like you get Michael to do it a lot sooner than Hollis. Maybe that's not true, but that's the perception, right? And so it's that whole idea. So if you kind of look at these organizations, it's like that. But I totally agree. Like, you know, inside of my own organization, inside of, you know, I go through all three of these cycles, maybe even on a daily basis.
Me too.
So, yeah. So it's not a negative thing. It's just what role you're playing and who they are. But it's very important to know and identify these people very clearly, because ultimately what happens is you as the marketer step out of this role, right? You stay a man of words. The fanatics and the men of action take over from there. And they're the ones who build your brand and create the cult brand for you, right? They do that heavy lifting on a daily basis. You don't have to do it anymore. You don't have to spend all of your time on social media, any of that kind of thing, because the mass of activity is happening from outside the organization. All right, you had a question?
I think we did it. We just did men of words. I think we're good.
Okay.
Now.
All right. So is there any other questions? Otherwise, I'm going to go back through this. I've got about 15 more minutes that we can go and then I've got to stop. But
yeah. So maybe some questions about like application. Also, somebody is, if he's available, who's done a really good job of a lot of this is Christopher Walker. I want to put Christopher Walker on here. I think he'd be
That'd be awesome.
Christopher, do you mind? Can Natalie put you on? Or just put him on. We'll embarrass him if he's doing something weird. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right.
Let's see.
So, Chris got me out of the keto thing. Remember, I was a crazy keto guy. No. I hung out. It was at a baby bathwater mastermind. Chris is, you know, has this little way, and he kind of just deconstructed my belief real subtly in his like really humble, weird, fake humble way that he does. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, fuck keto, and I switched over. And now I became like a thermo fanatic, which I still am. So it'd be cool, Chris, like, what did you do there? Because I'm a pretty rigid person. And once it's hard to move me, I got moved. I changed. I was willing to try yours. And I failed at first because I did it wrong. And then I somehow was in your forum. And then I was like, wait, I'm doing it wrong. And then I did it. It's the best thing ever. But you don't really do a lot. Your people do it for you. Like his little Facebook group, Chris doesn't do shit. He's been, but then his fanatics are crazy and they do it all for him. But so maybe it'd be cool for you guys to talk. I want Dave to deconstruct what Christopher did. I'm going to do that.
Let me see.
It was that shit.
Can you give me a frame of reference what Thermo is?
It's basically like a nutrition protocol that focuses on what's called bioenergetics. So it's like the flow of energy through the body from the cell upward. And it ends up being pretty much like the complete opposite of keto in terms of the whole carbs is the devil type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it focuses on basically like highly digestible, nutrient rich carbohydrate sources.
Mm.
And then like food quality and everything else. It's a very logical way of eating in terms of a framework.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I remember our conversations right, Michael, it was like it was a lot of like talking about the logic behind things,
mm-hmm. and,
you know, questioning. And I naturally am I'm a skeptic in many ways. And that's, I've just been really obsessed with health nutrition for the last 10 years. So that's kind of how I approached like my own way of looking at it. And then eventually this started kind of taking form. And I've been studying some of this, I read True Believer and it just blew my brain out. Like the first time I read it. So I continually like go through and read it. to try to like get those insights into like how this actually works. And it seems to be going pretty well so far. I mean, people are loving it. It actually gets incredible results. You feel amazing when you do it.
Well, it's weird. He created a free Facebook group. So he did it all free and he didn't have products behind it. I mean, Umazoo has products, but it wasn't a blatant pitch for his products at all. It was like, I'm just giving this, and it's so logical.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the fact that Chris doesn't get emotional, like, you know, you get me going, I fucking start blabbering, nobody understands me, I start spitting and stuff. But Chris doesn't, his like cerebralness and calmness about whatever you say to him, he just doesn't get offended. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, and then the ethos is like, it's just logic. And it's very much, and then very Socratic, it's very Socratic. And he's created a group that's free.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't ask for anything. You know, yeah, you could buy, but he didn't really, it wasn't like buy these products at all until later. And even then, his people in his group sell the product. He barely talks about the products at Umazoo or anything, but all the people in the group are comparing Umazoo products. They're recommending them to each other. He's not saying shit. It's crazy town.
Right. So, Michael, what was your desire for change? Why? I mean, you were keto for a long time and successful.
I was losing the weight. Feeling okay, but I was fucking, I wanted to fucking eat some carbs. I mean, I was like, yeah, I wasn't happy. I was losing the weight and I had some mental clarity, but it was becoming, it was getting in the way of my life. So the uncomfortable, it's taking off the bun shit.
Yeah.
And so also
Michael was discontented, right? So he was getting tired of it, but he also put the locus of control outside himself and he said,
yes,
it's keto, right? And that was a big thing. And then, so that's like meeting with the mentor at that right time, right? So you met him. Mm-hmm. And you realized there was, I mean, with Michael, there was no hope of change as an individual because he would change. Like that's one for sure thing about Michael that he, you know.
Well, mentally I'm open and I'm good at that, but physically it's always been a struggle. I was a fat kid. So it's always been outside, you know, in my mind, it was a locus out of it because it's never been something I've mastered. I've never mastered my body at any point in time. It's always been a point of struggle with me. So I've always looked outside of me because I don't have confidence in it. So I don't have that. So I am looking for outside help there.
Yeah. So Michael just gave you his label. He's a fat kid, right? And things are outside of his, like they've always been outside of his control. So he now there's the label, you know, and you don't have to say it like, Michael, you're a fat kid, because if you do that, Michael would say, fuck you and punch you in the face. But if or he might say, yeah, I was, and you know, like just a keto you, but that's okay too. But the point is like, he would recognize that in the dark. You heard that word fat kid, it'd be like, yeah, that's who I was like that. And I'm willing to listen, I'm willing to feel compassion for those people. I want, and I'm also interested in knowing what would have fixed what I can't already have fixed, you know. How can I fix my youth, right? We're all trying to fix our what happened to us in the past.
And how'd you make being a fanatic? I mean, I was going before like the quarantine, whenever I go to a restaurant in Boulder, I mean, like, you need a thermo menu. Like I go to restaurants and they have like thermo meals for me. Because I'm so passionate. I'm like an evangelist now. So I'm the fanatic stage of thermo.
You're at the fanatic stage. So first you start talking about telling everybody about it, right? You're like, you know, how you think about keto, you probably blasted keto, right? And you probably said, you know, I did it for so long, you're wrong. I know why, all those things, right? Mm-hmm. So you start blasting keto and other kind of bullshit diets. And you start really, you know, but people push back, right? And so they start telling you all the reasons you're wrong, right? Is that true?
I'll say it now because I'll say, go read Chris's shit.
Right.
But I want him to be my, I want to send him to the men of words. I can't say the words.
Right. But because the more people push back on you, the more fanatical you become. Right.
But I push them back to Chris because I'm like, go read him. I don't have time for this. And I'm not as smart as you. So go read Chris and you see.
But that's just a very subtle way of punching people in the face. I don't have time for this.
Right. Well, it's like, no, it's like you when you were proselytizing for your call, you'd be the cute kid and you bring him back to the adult to do the work.
Right. Totally. Totally. But, you know, in the meantime, like I would walk up and I would like really punch him in the face. Like, you're going to hell, Jezebel, with your whorish hair, you know, bobbed, your lipstick, your earrings, right? Like 6-year-old kid says that to you, like that causes a break in your reality for a moment. It's the same thing too. Like when Michael says, like, I don't have time for this. Go talk to Chris, right? That's a way, because like if Michael and I are friends and he says he doesn't have time for anything, that's equivalent to punching me in the face. Right?
It's more about I don't have the ammunition. Like, I'm not going to win this argument. I'm not a scientist.
That's what you think inside your head, but that's why you're a fanatic. And the more people say that, like, the more you want to push them to him. It's a very subtle way, right, of being the fanatic, though. Like, okay, great. I've got, because if you weren't a fanatic, right, what you'd just be, you'd be like, okay,
fuck it.
Whatever, right? But you don't. you just like slip them to Chris, and then Chris does the work, right? He's the man of action, and that's how that works. So that's why you're the fanatic and why he's that. But they're both very subtle if you look at it, right? It's not like Michael is out punching people in the face, literally like proselytizing against keto. He's just simply going out and saying, like, when people bring it up, he's like, here's the reasons why I don't think it works anymore. And people go, yeah, but what about this? And he goes, go talk to Chris.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with it, right? That's a fanatic. Like, I don't want to hear your bullshit. I just want to, you know, like, I don't want to deal with it. And at some point, you would get in an argument, like vehemently argue with somebody.
I'm wondering how Chris put it together, though.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you move Michael through this? And how do you think about it from a marketing perspective in terms of what you do?
Yeah, from the marketing perspective, I remember a few years ago, because initially I'd started like fleshing it out, and I wrote a book about natural testosterone production and like taking every single element of it from the micronutrients, nutrition, training, lifestyle. But I learned a lot from that, but I realized like that was a very niched, small thing, but the framework could translate to a lot of people, but a lot of people wouldn't read it because they didn't have that as an issue. So it was probably 3 years ago now where I kind of realized that like the philosophy itself is where the power is. And when somebody can understand a philosophy and buy into it and know the reasons why, that was something that would drive a lot wider, instead of just focusing on like a niche, one little thing, but building a true philosophy for nutrition based on a set of logical rules. And
yeah, that's what it is. He's a philosophy, not a diet. And then your enemy isn't necessarily keto. What is your enemy? Because it's not keto. Keto is this one example, but you have a bigger enemy. It's not, it's almost like stupidity is your enemy.
There's like levels of enemies that kind of unveiled themselves. It's almost like this, it's been this sequence of events, because one of the weird things that's almost convenient for, from the marketing side, is the fact that the more you dig into the nutrition and the set of constraints that we live in this world, as you mentioned earlier, is that there is this conspiracy element to it that's like almost unavoidable. When you look at the fact, like Michael, going to the restaurants, like almost every one of these restaurants, not just in Boulder, but like in the entire world, use polyunsaturated fat, vegetable oils for cooking. And they do so for who knows why, but probably economical reasons, because it's so damn cheap. But then when you go into the health side of it, they're toxic and they're rancid oils by the time they get hit with light or enter the human body, because of the heat of the body actually decouples the...
Yeah, like, no, that's funny, because I went to like Noodles and Company. Should be the zucchini, should be great for you, right? And then I went in and I've been doing it, and I was stalling. And I said, what oil do you cook your stuff in? It's best for, and I got furious, and I was like, just do mine in olive. And they're like, we don't do that. And I'm like, I'm gone, man. So it's like, because now vegetable oil to me is a trigger for you fucking asshole restaurant. Well, somehow, I'm indoctrinated. It's crazy.
Well, and then the weird thing is like I'm finishing up my book for Thermo right now. It'll be launching this year. But really in the book, I like dug deep into the histories behind these things, and the histories are fucking crazy. Like it actually deepens the conspiracy element to it, because like the history of vegetable oil was that it was originally a byproduct, like an industrial byproduct, that was like the seed oils were used for paint, and they had an excess of it that they started to put into the food supply through Procter and Gamble and some of those big, like the old school, like Crisco and all that stuff. And then if you actually look at like the propaganda that was used on that sort of thing by people like Edward Bernays, who's obviously a prolific propagandist, you look at the campaigns that they did to use these oils, it starts to like unveil this crazy...
Right, and now we're watching Out of the Shadows, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it's so curious, because it's like, again, I'm not saying there's a conspiracy, but the more you learn about it, you're like,
But if you wanted to point out how it was a conspiracy, right? Like if you were a food producer, and maybe you are, but if you were a food producer, right, you would point out that conspiracy, right? How all of these companies have conspired to do these things to you. That's what Big Sugar has done. So, you know, like sugar went from being a thing that you had in your Kool-Aid to now it's like an addictive drug that, you know, all these people are insidiously putting in all of their food, you know, and take sugar one step further to, you know, like corn syrup. And you've got, you know, now you've got this whole idea that it's become this whole thing, right? And so those conspiracies are what allow for everything else. And so whether you have to overtly identify them or not is up to you. But like, if you were producing like a big line of food, I would definitely overtly, you know, point out.
So I know you have limited time. So one, we're going to do a part two when you guys email, like, and we'll do like apply, but I wanted to do Chris's example. Last question to end it. So Chris is the one person man of words right now with Fanatics. How does he transfer to get other men of words to then be buying into it? So it becomes a movement. So he's just a part of a bigger movement. It doesn't have to be him anymore. How is that done? Cause I think that's where the real big thing hits.
Well, that's the part where you start looking at those people who are, you know, the Fanatics who are just not, they're like you, Michael. How does he get you, which you're already doing, right? But how does he get you to go from that person who's just doing the thing and, you know, you're breaking it now to say, look, I'm going to write a paper about this. I'm going to respond on social media about it. What you really do, though, is you elevate people's status, right, inside your community. So as people start really talking about, like, you know, they become very knowledgeable and they start sharing their results and that kind of thing, you elevate their status and you start doing exactly what Michael's doing now, is except that Chris pushes those people off to those other people and starts elevating their status and letting them be the person who is the spokesperson and the most obvious kind of person. And you do as many of those as you can, because it's a very enviable position to be in. And the more you can give them things like this, this is why gamification of software and all these things work. The more you can give them badges, the more you can give them, you know, symbols that they can use, things like that, that people, again, you know, language and symbols are things that people can use to identify themselves. The more people want to become that, and the more they do that, you know, it's almost like, you know, having things with you all the time that
you know,
are constantly locking you back to that idea. And that's exactly how you do it. So,
yeah, that's the next phase. And that's, if you master that, then it's a bunch of, and then what about recruiting another expert who had a slightly different thing that already if a person considered a man of words, a woman of words already to the thingy. So now they're advocating the same thing and it's way bigger. Is there a way to,
That's a whole other thing, right? That's conversion. Right. So that's a whole other sort of process, and that it's a really, really powerful one. Right. And you can move them directly to, but they sort of have to go through that fanatical phase themselves. Right. You have to convert them. They have to become the man of words who's talking about it. And then they have to go. But that process is usually very short for those people, because if you can convert them, right, they go from being unsaved, just like this guy did in the beginning of the movie. Right. He was unsaved. And then he got prayed for, and like, you know, just a few days later, bam, he's like a Christian again, and he's all these things, right?
Yeah, like Jim McCullough, like McCullough got converted to keto, and now keto's way bigger because he took all that tribe, and now they're all keto too, right? And that's fascinating, right?
Yeah. So, see, and McCullough's a great, that's a whole study in itself, right? He's done all kinds of things. He has all kinds of really crazy beliefs, right? Like, he's a perfect example of a cult. And, you know, to the point, like, he and a bunch of other people, but, you know, he used it to his advantage best when Google delisted him from everything, right? It's just another example of how the man is trying to keep you down, how he's trying to keep these secrets.
Yep.
Sort of like this. You remember Cobra, the ruthless terrorist organization? Who were they? What was their agenda? Did you know the people who gave them their weapon and resources? Well, it was Hasbro, the same corporation that funded and armed G.I. Joe, you bastards. Wake up, people, right? It's that whole idea, right? It's that whole simple idea that, you know, like there's always some devil, there's always something behind it. And if you can, you know, like if you can leverage the devil in that way and constantly point back to them, you'll find more and more people who see it everywhere. And
let's get McCullough to do Thermo. That'd be next. He's very convertible. Yeah. Well, very cool. So I know you got to get to another thing, Dave, but this has been fantastic. And I know this is a lot of theory, but I've seen Dave actually execute this stuff. And so I think next time we'll get on and get questions and talk about more tactical, because this is, we use like an evil example, but this doesn't have to be evil at all. And Dave,
in fact, it works every single day in marketing, and it works really, really well. So I think that, you know, if people are interested and they want to do it, I'm thrilled to come back, and we'll spend very little time talking about this stuff and a whole lot of time, you know, because this works in your copy, it works in your videos, it works in the books you write, it works in, you know, the emails that you write, every single thing. So when I, you know, no matter, whenever I'm doing this stuff for other people, this is literally the same format that we use. And there's obviously 1,000 different complexities to it, but, you know, it can really take just about anybody's stuff and show you where you can add things in that are going to be, you know, lever points that are going to make a big difference, because you activate different audiences, you activate different people, you move them through this cycle in a fluid way, and they convert.
Yeah,
very, very cool. Really,
have a, like an extra minute here. I'm curious about what your thoughts are about why it works. Like reading True Believer, that was the first thing that went in my head. I was like, wait, I know every single sentence in this book is true in some way. Like you can just feel it because you've seen it.
Yeah.
And what was most disturbing, I was like, why the hell is this true? Because it seems so mechanical.
Right. It does seem mechanical when it's broken down. The reason it's true is that it is because of our education and our, you know, our orientation in the world, right? So this is from our earliest childhood, we've had experiences of being, you know, segmented. You know, there were cool kids, there were not cool kids. There's all of these things that we learn socially as we're growing up. From the time we're born, we have, you know, like churches do this stuff. If you go to church, if you don't go to church, you have social groups that do it. It's all of the kinds of things that we're indoctrinated with and taught as we grow up. And, you know, as that happens, this just overlays it. And at some point you probably realize like things were outside of your control when you were younger and you're trying to take that control back. And then you're looking for a similar sort of thing, and mass movements often provide that.
Well, society doesn't work without it. We could talk all day, but it doesn't work. If we weren't like this, nothing would work.
Right. Exactly.
So this is very cool. Well, I can't wait for part two. Thanks to Chris for being, because I think this is great to have you as kind of an example of something, because you're kind of doing a lot of this, I think, and obviously pretty consciously. And having Dave grill you, I think I want to do more of that. I think this could be really fun.
Yeah, I'd love to do another one.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
See you guys.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye.